So, now we come to most, I think, the most important section of the book, in a way. This section called Illustration. And I think that, Alexander never wrote a book, you could say, specifically for students on a training course. Even though the Universal Constant was written at the time when he'd had a number of years of experience of a training course, it was very much a book for everybody. It wasn't just specifically addressed to students. And of course, this, as I said yesterday, was written before he'd actually started to run a training course. But I do believe that if he had been asked by students, now, what is the really most important bit of my writings to read and study and make sure you understand, he would have called attention to this. And I say that because he always used to say that the procedure that's described, putting hands on the back of the chair, was absolutely the key procedure. It was what anybody needed to learn and know and understand if they were going to use their hands as an Alexander teacher. If you were going to use your hands in the way that we use our hands, as distinct from the way that a masseur does massage, from the way that the osteopath does adjustments and manipulations, the surgeon uses the scalpel and the instruments, and people use their hands to do things in all sorts of different ways, but the particular Alexander way of using the hands, this is what this illustration is about. And furthermore, two things I would like to say. One is that some people have written about the technique and written about the work and said, why do we have to use the hands? Surely the hands aren't all that important. Surely the main thing is to explain to people and to using words and so on to teach them as you teach anything else. And they suggest that the use of the hands is only of secondary importance. Well, Alexander's own life experience was absolutely the contrary. He started out by believing that, of course, you could just simply, in words, you could talk to anybody and you could say to them, well, look, now, this is what you need. You mustn't stiffen your neck. You must let your neck be free. You've got to this, that, and the other. You can explain it all in words, And you don't really need your hands at all. There's no need, and so you can take a large group of people without using your hands. Because of course, if you've got a large group of people, you're not going to be able to get round and put hands on them all. But no, his experience, and certainly my experience and the experience of other teachers, has been that what you convey with your hands, what the experience that you're able to give with your hands, is an experience that can't really be given any other way, and it is the essential experience if people are going to learn how to help themselves, how to employ the technique. So it is very, very definitely a matter of the use of the hands. Another thing is that in talking about the technique and describing the technique, you can suggest that there are a number of interesting topics that you could talk about and that Alexander writes about, such as end gaining, means whereby, defective sensory appreciation, all these different things, all fine, all important, and so on. But the most important thing of all is the practical thing of how indeed you use your hands, how you put your hands on somebody in order to convey to them the required experience. So, I regard this section, this chapter, as really of key importance, and I recommend it to you, and I'm going to read it now and go through it and try and explain it as far as I can, but I do strongly recommend you to read it for yourself and try and understand it too. And of course, if you find that there are things that you don't understand, but the difficulties that present themselves, well, please say so. Please say so to me or to any of us, and ask for help to understand. Don't just dismiss it as something that isn't important, that perhaps you'll understand one day, but let's see if we can't be quite clear about it now. So, the first beginnings. In the technical evolution about to be set down, it is necessary to use certain phrases employed in the teaching technique. Phrases which I consider call for comment, seeing that they do not always adequately express my meaning, and that furthermore they cannot be defended as being demonstrably accurate. My reader may justly ask then, why do I use them? Readers of Man's Supreme Inheritance will remember that when I use the phrase position of mechanical advantage, I pointed out that I did so because a better one was not forthcoming. And I mentioned then that I'd called to my aid a number of scientific and literary friends. I've pursued the same course in regard to the phrases which will follow. As I've already stated, I think them inadequate, but with a teacher present to demonstrate in person what he means by them, they serve their purpose. Now, you see, he mentions, for instance, the position of mechanical advantage. Now, that was a term that, of course, I would say originated in engineering circles. Engineers understand what is meant by mechanical advantage. To a lot of non-practical people, of course, the expression is unfamiliar, and at first they may not understand it at all. The classical engineering description, the classical engineering explanation is like this. You have a great big rock, a great big boulder here, and you want to move it. And obviously it's too big and it's too heavy to respond to your own strength. You can go and push it with your hands or and do what you like, and you'll find that it won't move. So the engineer goes and gets two things. He gets what he calls a lever, usually an iron rod or a steel rod or something like that, pretty long one, and he gets another smallish stone, and he takes the lever and he shoves the end of it underneath a bit of the rock that he wants to move, and he takes the small stone and he puts that underneath the lever. Then he goes to the far end of the lever, the end away from the stone, and he leans his weight on the end of the lever, and because the lever is pivoted on the small stone, the force that is transmitted through the lever, through the whole setup, is sufficient to move the great big rock. So in other words, the contrivance of the lever with the fulcrum, as it's called, the pivotal thing, the little stone, the contrivance enables him to multiply his own strength, to make his own strength so much more effective that without the lever he couldn't move the rock. With the lever it will move. So the setup gives him mechanical advantage. So that's what mechanical advantage means simply in engineering terms. It means you contrive a setup so that you get maximum return, you get a maximum force in your input. It may be small, and you magnify the output, and so on. Now, when we, in our teaching, when we go into monkey, in the attitude that we adopt, the familiar, the attitude that's perfectly familiar to you all, you will find that you are able, in that attitude, to use your hands, to use your body, to use your own strength very much more effectively than if you just stood perfectly upright with straight legs and so on. And this shouldn't come as a surprise, because you know perfectly well that if you're going to lift something heavy from the ground, if you go and stand with straight legs and bend your back and try and lift it up, you either won't be able to lift it or you do yourself harm. Whereas if you let your knees go, bend your knees and keep your back straight and keep your length and so on, then you can apply the force and lift it, and that's mechanical advantage. So as he points out at the beginning here, there's a phrase that at first sight people wouldn't understand, but when it's explained, when you go into it, you can see that it's a very useful phrase and worth the trouble of understanding it. Well, same applies to all these other expressions that we use, and the first one he takes is shortening the spine. Oh, and I might say just one other thing before continuing with that, and that is that we say the words, literally, I've just said the words, shortening the spine. Next, having heard the words, you need to think about them, to understand them a bit. So, thought is needed after the words, but when you've thought about it, then of course an understanding can develop, and you can understand that perhaps you don't want to shorten the spine. And when you've understood that you don't want to shorten the spine, then the next step is you can wish not to do it. And in the end, it's what you wish that counts above everything else. So what you wish is far more important than the words. What you wish is even more important than the thought. It is, in the end, the wish that really counts. So here are the words, shorten the spine. An objector might justly say that this is practically impossible. But we are dealing with the use of the spine. We're dealing with the use of the spine. And one of the most common defects amongst human beings today is an undue curving of the spine in the use of the self in the acts of everyday life. And naturally, this causes a shortening in stature. As a practical demonstration, take a piece of paper and after placing it flat on another sheet, draw a line along the extreme edge of the top piece, thereby recording the length by the pencil mark on the paper underneath. Now, lift the top piece and curve it slightly, and replace it with one end touching one line and without interfering with the curve. It will then be seen that the other end of the paper does not reach the other line. So, of course, when you curve it, you shorten it. That's what is meant by shortening. The curves of the spine, as we all know, are a natural feature. That's how our spines are supposed to be. They're supposed to have the curve of the neck, the upper curve, the thoracic curve, the lower curve, the lumbar curve, the sacral curve, and of course the curve of the last little bit, the tail, the coccyx. So you've got a series of curves. Now clearly, if those curves are greatly, or any of them are greatly increased, exaggerated, then the overall effect is shortening the spine. So I think that spells that out pretty thoroughly. You can't really go much further than that. So we come to the second thing, which is lengthening the spine. The foregoing will serve to show that if we modify the curve in the spine, we tend to lengthen it. For instance, to go back to our illustration, if we take the curve out of the top piece of paper and replace it as in the first instance, it will reach both lines, showing that during the experiment a lengthening process has been operative. Well, you know, you can't really say much more about that, but you might say that it's so obvious. Why do you have to emphasize it in such detail? Well, people do, as individuals, think all sorts of different things. You never know how people will interpret words. And you see, when you talk about spines and so on, people think of things like the spinal discs, which they've learned are sort of like washers between the bones, and they think, ah yes, well of course you can compress the bones together, you can swash the discs, and of course if you squash the discs, then the spine is obviously being shortened. It so overall length is being reduced. If, on the other hand, you take the ends of the spine and pull them apart, and you pull hard enough to take the pressure off the discs, then the spine lengthens. But in our teaching, in the technique, we're not thinking about things like that. We're simply thinking about the increase of the curve or the decrease of the curve. Here is somebody standing in front of you, and they're poking their head forward, and they've got, obviously, a very exaggerated curve of the neck. Their spine is shortened. Here you have somebody standing in front of you and standing very straight, incidentally very stiffly, very fixed, and the curves are all flattened. Yes, they are then indeed lengthening, indeed over lengthening. The lengthening that is taking place is then unnatural. What we want is natural lengthening, or to put it this way, we want to ensure that we avoid shortening. Then we come to the third thing, which is very, very important indeed, and that is relax the neck. Now, of course, in these days you won't hear Alexander teachers say relax the neck. We've been advised, and we found from experience, that it's better not to use the word relax these days, because it is so easily misunderstood. But at the time that this book was written, Alexander was still using the word relax, and as he said in his younger days, it used to be a word that you could use quite safely without people suddenly collapsing all of a heap and acting as though they were nearly dead. So relax just used to mean don't make so much effort, just free it up, make a little bit less effort, free yourself. That's what it used to mean. But anyway, at this time, the phrase was relax the neck. There is a considerable confusion on the part of the pupil when he attempts to obey directions to relax some part of the organism. In ordinary teaching, pupils and teachers are quite convinced that if some part of the organism is too tense, they can relax it. That is, do the relaxation by direct means. This is a delusion on their part, but it is difficult to convince them of it. In the first place, if they do chance to get rid of the specific tension, it will be by a partial collapse of the parts concerned, or of other parts, possibly even by general collapse of the whole organism. In the second place, it's obvious that if some part of the organism is unduly tensed, it is because the pupil is attempting to do with it the work of some other part or parts. Often work for which it is quite unsuited. So when we say relax the neck, we nowadays say the neck to be free, to think of the neck being free. And just quite shortly, finally, about the neck being free, here is the consideration. If you sit as you're sitting now and you ask yourself, is my neck free? You won't know the answer. Nobody can just sit and feel the neck and say, ah, yes, my neck is free. But supposing, as you sit here, you decide to have a look round the room. So you decide to move your head and to have a look round. Now, if you find that when you go to look round and you move your head, that there's some difficulty in moving it, that it doesn't move freely as you want it to do, well, it must be stiff, mustn't it? So you've got a very simple way of knowing whether your neck is stiff or free by seeing whether you can move it or not. If you can move it, it's free. If you can't move it, it's stiff. But of course the point is not whether it is at this present moment stiff or free. The critical point is what we're going to come on to next, which is what happens when you actually do something, when you actually make a movement, when you stand up. At that point, when you do something, do you in fact then stiffen your neck, or do you manage to carry out the movement, the action, leaving the neck alone, leaving it free? So that's where we'll stop.